This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And here we are stretching across the universe, stretching across to the other side of the country, because we've got to our attention someone who I've heard about, known about for a long period of time, and has recently come to me through the New York Times. I saw the article. Rachel, are you there?
Hi.
What a nice thing. What a nice thing. So I said, oh boy, if we could just get Rachel to be on the program, because this is what we talk about. I have certain questions I would like to ask her. And luckily, she responded. She must have 1,000 requests. You must have gotten a lot of response, huh?
We literally got hundreds of emails, and from doctors and medical students and the parents of medical students and sick people, well people. I mean, it was just, it's been amazing. It hasn't stopped yet.
Yeah. Yeah,
it turned out to be the number one most commonly emailed article from the New York Times this month.
Wow.
I can't believe this. It's quite wonderful, though. It's quite wonderful.
Well, then why do you allow us, poor little WBAI over here on the East Coast, suddenly the privilege of being able to get high priority?
Because I've heard of WBAI. And it's my kind of radio station, shall we say. And yours too, apparently.
Right. And you and I know each other for quite a while in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back over those names. There were so many of them. Do you remember Marge King?
Yes.
Sure, Marge King. And
you know, I think of all the people we know in common, you and I are the only people who have never actually met face to face.
No, everybody kept talking about you.
That's right. So here it is 30 years later, and we still haven't met face to face.
Well, we're going to do something about that. Maybe not. Maybe we'll just
exist
in spirit.
What a wonderful radio show you're doing.
I'm really glad. I love it. We've been here for many, many years, and what a great opportunity. Let's talk about what this stuff is about so people could know, other than how to make good friends and choose good people. It's about medicine. It's Dr. Rachel Remen, and she is a physician, and she's a physician who has been shaking up the globe by trying to teach people something about doctoring. I'm going to do it in your words, Rachel. What would you say the thing is that you're trying to teach?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I'm a professor of medicine also at UCSF School of Medicine, and I run an institute called the Institute for the Study of Health and Illness at Commonweal in Bolinas, California. And the institute is a change agent, and that's what I'm working on. I'm trying to change medicine back to what it used to be, which is a way of life. Even a spiritual path, you know, characterized by such things as harmlessness, service, a reverence for life, compassion, kindness, brotherhood. Brotherhood is a big one. You know, Maimonides in the 14th century said something like this: may I see in all who suffer only the fellow human being, which is part of his oath. The oath of Maimonides is often said at graduation by brand new doctors as they graduate from medical school. That's what brotherhood is about. We are fellow human beings, no more, no less, and our medicine is based on that connection, not on science, on that connection, the human connection. So don't get me started, obviously.
Well, I would, you know, it's so beautiful to hear you talking about it, because it has such meaning to me in so many ways. You know, Maimonides is very different than Hippocratic Oath.
Yes, it is very different, and but the Hippocratic Oath also is a prayer. All of these things are prayers. And, you know, the reason I'm on your show, I assume, is that I started this medical school course, radical, guerrilla-type course. It's an elective at UCSF 22 years ago called The Healer's Art, which was an effort to remind entering medical students that medicine was a work of the heart. It's a work of love. a certain kind of love, and it's a work of the soul as well. It's a calling. And I did this at UCSF for 2 years, and then it started to spread by word of mouth across the country. People, academics in medical meetings, you know, that they would go to, somebody, Harry, you know, what's new? And someone would say, I'm teaching this unbelievable course to the students. And then the person they were talking to would call us up and say, train us to teach it. So it's in more than half of America's medical schools now, and okay, in medical schools in 7 countries. I mean, like Slovenia and Brazil and India and Israel and Canada and Australia. I mean, unbelievable. 2,000 medical students take it every year.
So the essence of it is humanized medicine.
The essence of it is authentic medicine. Armand.
Humanized authentic medicine?
Real medicine.
Oh, so real medicine includes
humanized. Science is only our most recent tool. Medicine is a way of life, and it's about service. It's about befriending the life in other people and helping them to live their best life, whether they're sick or well.
You mean medicine is not about procedures and medications?
No.
And
no, it's not about tools.
It's not about tools.
No, it's a way of life. And it's our way of life, and it's a calling in many ways. In working with these first year students, when you begin to do, you know, imagery work with them and helping them to remember themselves, remembering their original values. Listening to them, not telling them how they're supposed to be, but listening to how they already are. They are called to this way of life. They've been people of service ever since they've been very, very, very young. And we get them to remember that, and to, among other things, and to tell the stories from when they were 4 years old and 5 years old, when they responded to the needs of living things with caring and compassion and action.
We're listening to Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen describe to us some of the things that she described, that she's taught and teaches teachers to teach about the community, about medicine being a healing art once again and bringing it back to the healing arts. There are so many physicians I know who are just lost in the procedures and the pills and the insurance companies. They're absolutely gone. But here's where I want to take it. Of course, we can now look at that and we could say, Naomi, oh, the doctors have got to become human again and they've got to do what they're supposed to do. But right from the get-go, you get into medical school, they torture you. They rip away your brain. They force you to stay up all night. They shove you through emergency rooms. They do brutal things to these kids to dehumanize them. Almost as if it's like military training. It's almost like if we shoot enough bullets at you, eventually you'll be able to stand up at a battlefield and shoot other people. Don't you think that it's...
I really would say that, first of all, you can't eradicate people's deepest values. The way their essential nature cannot be eradicated, be covered over. It can be forgotten. But it can be brought back really easily. But let me just say that I think many doctors suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, that you've seen so much and you've never had any chance to process that, to grieve for people, to cry about things. We've even forgotten how to celebrate people's successes. Recently, I had a bad back and I had an epidural injection. And I talked to 15 people, and I met my surgeon who was going to do this procedure. I had met her 8 minutes before the procedure, long enough to tell her it was my left leg that was the problem, not my right leg, like it said in the computer. It was my left leg. And I had the procedure. I had a kind of a twilight sleep. And when I awoke, I had been in terrible pain. When I awoke, a nurse came to me and said, how are you? And I said, I'm awake. And she said, wait, I'll get the doctor, who I only met for 8 minutes. And this wonderful woman comes to the bedside again, tremendously present human being, and says to me, how are you? And I said, I have no pain. And she looks deep into my eyes and she says, I am so glad. And, you know, I have a chronic illness for the last 60 years. I have
You've had it forever, right?
I have hundreds of doctors, hundreds. Mm. No one has ever said anything like that to me. Mm. And that's the human connection. If she wasn't glad at being able to relieve pain, she wouldn't be there. She wouldn't have gone through all that training. She wouldn't have sacrificed her whole youth to this thing. And yet, somehow or other, it gets buried so deep that it never comes out of our mouths. And it meant so much to me. I am so glad you are out of pain. And it was joyful when she said it. This woman who I'd met for 8 minutes, we're connected, she and I.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously.
But it's not a question of time.
Let me ask you, Naomi, though. When it comes to pain, pain is such an important issue to deal with in medicine because in some way it's almost as if by law you must take a person out of pain. So we give them the medications for the pain. I'm thinking about, you know, some of the procedures you do over at the Mayo Clinic where they have these programs to step you away from treating pain as an entity itself and treating it like it needs respect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pain is only pain.
Mm-hmm.
Is our job to relieve pain, or is our job to relieve the condition that causes the pain?
It's our job to relieve suffering.
Oh, boy.
And not all suffering has any, and why should we leave? To create a freedom from suffering for people. That doesn't mean that their pain will go away. It means their suffering will
okay,
go
so
away.
The suffering
is a different thing.
That's right. The suffering could be the assumption that the pain should go away, as opposed to you don't have to suffer even if you have the pain.
Well, here's the thing, of course. Relieving the pain is the dream of every physician and every patient, too. I mean, the pain is difficult, but not all pain is physical and not all pain can be relieved.
Mm-hmm.
But pain is one of the great teachers in this lifetime. My own experience, I've had major abdominal surgery 9 times. You know, I don't have most of my intestine anymore. I have something called an ileostomy for many, many years. I mean, I was 15 years old when I became sick. And something in me grew in response to this. Like my body is diminished, but myself is much larger, and not just that, but my ability to listen to other people, to connect to them through our common vulnerability to suffering.
Mm.
So in a funny way, I am more of a person and less of a physical person, if you want to think of it that way. And that's always possible. This is what healing is. It's different than curing. We have focused our medicine so much on curing, and not everything can be cured. A lot of people are living with situations and conditions that they would have died of as short a time ago as 20 years ago. But they're living with these things, and they're not cured, but they may be healed as human beings. They may be more compassionate, more loving, more capable of wisdom and of knowing what's important and what isn't in life. And this is all part of medicine. You know, we've gotten so caught up in the science of it that we've forgotten the purpose of it, if you want to think of it that way. And, you know, the course is about this. It's about keeping that purpose alive in the young people, despite what might be called the hidden curriculum, the shadow. I'm sure you and I know what this means. The shadow of medicine is long, and people repress parts of themselves that they don't get approval for within a very, very cognitive things that are expressed in numbers are truer than things expressed in words, kind of an environment.
Well, let's talk about the shadow a bit, the shadow of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important thing. Describe it, if you would.
Well, I describe it by telling you something about the course. The course is preventative. It doesn't teach anybody anything.
Where is the course taught, by the way?
This is not about teaching. The faculty and students learn together in a community of inquiry where there are no teachers. The teacher is diffused throughout the room, and we're drawing on our human experience to understand what medicine is about and what's important and what matters, right? So the very first thing we do is to talk about wholeness and to make it clear to the students that the schools do very important things. They will train them to be very, very fine physicians, but they won't care for their wholeness. That's the job of each person, to care for your own wholeness. And in this process, we ask them to draw a picture. And, you know, they've only been in school 4 months, but they have already encountered the shadow and the hidden curriculum. We ask them to draw a picture of a part of themselves that they feel they can't bring them with them into this training. A part of themselves that they leave at home because they're not getting a whole lot of approval for it within this training. And to draw a picture of it, and we give them Crayolas and big pieces of paper, and it smells like kindergarten in there, you know, and everyone gets down on the floor and draws a picture. And the first time we did this 22 years ago, I was stunned because everyone was hiding their picture as they were drawing it. They were leaned over it. And then halfway through, you ask them, would you write a word? Step back for a minute. Stop drawing. Write a word that describes a human quality or characteristic that this picture symbolizes. What is a word? Write the word down that this picture symbolizes. If this was a symbol, what would it be a symbol of? And then I started walking through the room and looking at the words. There are words like this. Innocence. Right? Not knowing. Right? Love. Right? Softness. Right? Touching. You know, things like this. And what was folding out there were the qualities of the Hippocratic Oath, which were being suppressed in these students because they were not getting approval for this. They were getting approval for what they knew and what they, their technology, their ability to make rapid decisions. All of this is all important. But they were paying a real high price for it. And then they go into small groups and they each hold up their pictures and they show each other the parts of themselves that have become orphaned.
Well, you know,
that are in the shadow. And you know what they say to each other? I thought I was alone. I didn't know other people were struggling. Everybody looks like they're on top of everything. Everyone is so smart. We're all wearing masks.
Naomi, it sounds like what you're doing in a medical training school is introducing a beautiful group therapy that helps people recognize their humanness and their frailties.
Exactly.
Now is
and
this
to
only...
use them to connect to other people.
Is this only taught...
I love this, Armand, that you call me Naomi. I haven't been called Naomi in 25 years.
Oh, really?
That's
I'm sorry.
My old name from when we used to know each other. It's my middle name. Oh. I go by Rachel these days.
Oh,
I love it.
I'm sorry. It just slipped in. I think that's how people refer to you as well.
Yeah.
Why don't we call you Dr. Remen so people can...
Oh, God, nobody does.
Nobody does.
No, don't.
Rachel, Naomi, Dr. Remen. Let me ask you something. I want to ask you a bunch about the emotions as well, but is this a course that is taught only in a medical school?
No, actually not. First of all, it's not taught. It's a community of inquiry.
I understand.
And
thank
it
you.
Changes the faculty as profoundly as it and strengthens them as much as it changes the students. No, it's taught in veterinary schools. We have just developed a course for nurses. And, of course, the shadow of nursing is somewhat different than the shadow of medicine. And this addresses the shadow of nursing. It's called the power of nursing. There are people who are beginning to take this into the legal profession, which has its own issues.
And the psychology profession, I'm sure.
Well, you know, not as much.
I know, I would imagine.
Not as much. It's, I think it's psychology that saved me, certainly. You know, I'm trained in psychosynthesis originally.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I was one of those people from the old Institute for the Study of Humanistic Medicine back in the day. And when this is what reminded me that I had been wounded by my training, and I hadn't even known.
The public doesn't get a chance to do this, right? They can't get the training. Don't you have the training on tape or on?
We do a lot of. This is only one of our programs at the Institute. This is the program. The program that was described in the New York Times is a program for medical students. But we do continuing medical education. We do teleconferences that everybody's involved with. Usually, it's mixed groups of doctors, nurses, teachers, anyone in the service professions.
Anybody in the service profession. But if, let's say, we have a group of people listening right now, and they're saying, you know, this is the kind of thing. Whereas, if I could learn about my body, learn about my own health, and at the same time learn about the underside of me, I would love that combined as a learning technique. I would love this combined as a course, so that the public who is supposed to be the other side of the healing profession.
But they're not the other side.
They're not.
Do the healing.
No, absolutely. But why aren't they getting access to the same training?
Because I'm a human being that can only do one thing.
Well, you got to designate some new soldiers.
I'm part of a much larger movement, I think, Armand.
Yeah, but you have a big gang.
You have that I have.
You have a powerful gang of people who are your students, and I know there's a large group of people who are saying that they could help you with the work. Are we reaching out to the public? Are we getting out there to get John Q to be able to come in and say, listen, I didn't go to school, but I would like to learn all of this stuff.
It's not what I teach.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, I don't teach anything, as a matter of fact. I'm doing this in the area that I know the best. It is an area that has a lot of importance to almost everybody. So I figured, what was the fulcrum of change? And I had access to something that most people don't have access to, which is the medical training.
Sure.
And when you change that, you change everything.
Yeah. You know, I know Cherry Quincy. Do you know who that is?
No.
Cherry Quincy's a wonderful being. She's one of the people who directed me to you originally. And she's in right up there in Santa Rosa, California. And she's been trying to do similar kind of work for many years. So the two of you have got to get together. And she's
really, yeah.
Yeah, she's a wonderful physician. She's fabulous. And at the same time, I've always had this claim in that we've got to somehow get the rest of the people involved. Now, when it comes to emotions, when it comes to feelings, I want to ask you, as a physician now, going beyond the project that you're doing, I want to know of the role of the emotions in trying to help people get with the work. Like, for example, you're doing grief and death work. Emotions are very important.
Yeah, I do. I'm a hospice person as well.
So when you're doing grief and death, therefore you're dealing with that whole range of emotions.
And a lot more beside emotion of values, very, very deep values, spiritual experiences of great power.
Well, tell me about the values.
Well, you know, this is the time, the view from the edge of life is so much clearer than the view that most of us have, Armand. Mm. In all the years that I've done one-on-one counseling with people who are dying, and I've done a lot of this, no one has ever said to me, you know, if I die of this cancer or if I die of this stroke or this heart attack, I'm going to miss my Mercedes. You ask people, you know, what would you change? And you know what they say? They would love more and work less. Simple, over and over and over again. And, you know, this kind of emergence of what matters, what's important, I see each dying person as a teacher of how to live to almost everyone around them.
So you see, each dying
person.
Sometimes by
negative example, sometimes by positive example. Mm-hmm. But people who are at the edge of life often have a generational long influence on family, on friends. They've learned a lot about what's important, and that's the thing that all of us sort of get distracted from. Just saying to people, what's important to you? And then listening is one of the most important things you can do for anyone else. You know, by the way, let me just go back to the course for a minute. The course is based on a single technique, which I call, and the students named it, generous listening. What that means is that most people, when someone's talking to them, they're really busy inside. They may not be fully aware of it even. But basically you're saying, do I like this person? Do I like what they're saying? Do I believe what they're saying or not? You know, are they smarter than I am? Not as smart as I am. Are they more educated than I am? And of course, if you're a doctor or a nurse or a psychologist, there's that other training that comes in. So someone is trying to talk to you about something that's important to them, and you're saying, what's wrong with this person? Do I know how to fix it? And if I don't know how to fix it, who do I call in? Very busy. And in this course, the first thing that the only thing we actually teach anybody is this, that in here we don't listen like that. In here we don't even listen to understand why a person thinks the way they do or why they feel the way they do. That doesn't matter. We listen for one thing only. What is true for this other person at this very moment? We just want to share, hear, receive, and know what matters.
Could you give me an example of that in a situation between a physician and a patient?
Just there. I mean, you know, there's a wonderful study out. I believe the average number of minutes before a patient is interrupted by his doctor as he's talking and trying to say what his issue is something like you get to talk for at the most 9 minutes.
Wow.
Before the doctor comes in and cuts you off and begins to offer whatever. And, you know, that's basically presence, which is what we're talking about, being present to another person, bringing your full self into relationship with another person so they're not alone with whatever it is that they want to share with you. And you better believe if you happen to be a health professional, it's something important that they want to share with you. That is the basic relationship that underlies all healing. It's simply to know another person, to be there for them. And often they can discover, as you listen for what's true for them, they can discover what's true for them for the first time. I mean, they're safe enough. Harmlessness is the first quality of the Hippocratic Oath. And becoming harmless, we are not harmless with each other. We judge each other. We do violence to each other psychologically all the time. You know, how can anyone tell you something vulnerable if you're not harmless in the moment that you're listening to them? You're receiving them, not judging them. You know this as a therapist, Armand. This is what allows people to heal.
Well, yes, but let me just stick with the question I was asking before. I wanted to just check the role of anger in medicine. What do you think?
Very important.
A powerful thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing that makes people feel like they've got any kind of muscle at all when they're feeling powerless.
Oh, I see it a little differently than that.
But, I mean, okay.
I mean, having been an angry person for the first 15 years of my chronic illness, which separated me from all people my own age, which was 15 to maybe 30, anger is the will to live. The will to resist distortion often in medicine. I always worry when people get a diagnosis like cancer and they don't have in some way a response that says no. because that kind of a response, if it becomes turned around and experienced directly for what it is, which is the will to live, can make a great difference for people. It can enable them to undergo very difficult treatments. It can enable them to transcend an illness often. Or, let's put it this way, my own experience, to live a good life, even though it hasn't been a very easy life. 9 major surgeries are mine. I'm a million miler as a patient in a hospital.
Yeah. It must have done a great deal for you, is it?
A life of passion and meaning. It's accessible to everyone. But anger is often the doorway, the first doorway. The only problem with it is when it becomes a way of life. When anger becomes a way of life, it diminishes you. It robs you of your true power. But as an opening gambit, not bad at all.
We're listening with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen. We are going to be right back. We're going to take a very short break. Could you stick with us, Rachel? You're not in too much of a hurry, are you?
No, not at all.
Hang on here. We'll order a pizza. Hold on, we'll be...
I love it. A New York pizza, please.
Of course. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You are listening to The Positive Mind with Armand Jamil on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information, and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you. By bringing you Truth in Radio.
And this is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind. We are speaking with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen. Naomi. From USFC School of Medicine, she's just a hot shot. You know what I mean? She's just one of these people who are shaking up all over town. You call California and say, what's going on? And they say, Rachel's doing her stuff. Right? It makes a difference. You are you're a difference maker. And turns out that she and I have run across each other throughout the years, over the years. When she heard my name and the name of the program, she jumped to be willing to give us an interview while everybody else is pounding on her doors as a result of an article, lead article, in the New York Times. The article was really beautiful, by the way.
You know, it really was. This guy
started interviewing.
You know, a lot of the people who teach this course at their school are deans. They're deans of the school. And he interviewed three of the deans, and then he started interviewing medical students. And he was just blown away. There was one thing that didn't get into the article. Let me tell you about it because it's so beautiful. At the very end of the course, it's a 15-hour course, and it's at the end of it, we help everybody in the room, faculty, students, write on their own personal Hippocratic Oath, their own personal commitment to their patients. In their own words, not the ancient words, but the words that are written on their own hearts. And then we read them out loud. And the first time we did this, a young woman stood up. And you know, more than half of American medical students these days are young women. They are. So she stands up. This was years ago, 22 years ago. And she looks
at her classmates
and she looks at her faculty and she says, I had no idea that's who you people were. I thought I was here alone. After listening to people's deep commitment, which is hidden, we never talk to each other about stuff like this. So he had said, when I told him this, can you tell me one of these? And I told him one that was written by a former football player, college football player, this big, hunky kid. And he says he's been in medical school 4 months, and he says, I want to be a surgeon. And I wrote this just now in the writing thing. I wrote this for my future patients. Right? Get your tissues out, Armand. He says, may you find in me the mother of the world. May my hands be a mother's hands, my heart be a mother's heart. May my response to your suffering be a mother's response to your suffering. May I sit with you in the dark as a mother sits in the dark. May you know through our relationship that there is something in this world that can be trusted. Now, you add to that a lot of science and a lot of technique, but this is what drives it all. This is what keeps people at it. This wish to use their lives in a certain way, then you really have something. The science alone doesn't heal anybody. It cures people, and when that happens, that's wonderful. But it doesn't happen as often as we hope it would. A lot of people are living with something. And this other thing, accompanying people, supporting them, helping them remember themselves and their strength despite illness. Very important part of this thing.
Well, this is, we're speaking with Dr. Naomi. Nah, we're not.
That's good.
I know. I'm just doing
it
that way.
Rachel, you know what's very funny? And just talking to you, I hear my New York accent coming back.
Yeah.
It's been 45 years I've been out here in California, and I'm starting to talk like a New Yorker
Don't you love that? You know, what we're talking about in New York, is there any place around the East Coast that people could get a taste of your kind of medicine?
Well, I'm sure there are many, many people.
I know many people, but do you have...
But, you know, it is... it's taught at NYU. It's taught, oh, my goodness, at Harvard and Dartmouth. And the course is in 71 medical schools.
And what's the course called?
Medical schools.
What's the course called?
The Healer's Art.
The Healer's Art.
Remembering the Heart of Medicine. It has a subtitle. The Healer's Art, Remembering the Heart of Medicine.
It must be an elective.
It is an elective because you can't legislate personal growth like
that. Right,
it.
Of course.
You know that.
Of course, but we wonder...
You know about, so in many, many, many places, half the class will sign up for it, even though they're working, you know, like people barely have time to sleep and eat, and they'll take on an extra course because it's about this and this is very important to them.
What do you think about that part?
What the students say at every school is that the course fills a gap in their medical education. They never get to talk about service. They never get to talk about why they're there or who they are. As a matter of fact, one of the deans actually said years ago, after he taught the course once, he said, God, he said, I've been teaching these kids for years. I had no idea who they were. I thought they came here empty. They're not empty. They're coming here because of the same reasons that students have come to medicine for thousands of years. He says they are very powerful people, and we have made them small. And I get tears in my eyes when I think about that. They are very powerful people and deeply good people. The students are amazing. 4 years later, they're depressed, cynical, alienated. The shadow of medicine is there in the training, and it's very difficult.
It's so hard to wake the heart of the physician. And I know because I come in contact with so many of them through my practice in many different forms, but it's like the heart went away somewhere. They have it on reserve.
They've kept it safe by walling it off.
I know.
But here's the thing that's interesting. You know, I mentioned we do CME work, we do teleconferences, stuff like this. And the doctors say, this is a typical remark, I always knew what was important to me. I never knew it was possible to live by it. And is this true of all of us? We're all living by somebody else's values, really? That our real values, we either we don't believe we can live by them or we don't know how to live by them, you know? And one of the things that's important is to find a place where you can be heard, where you can express it first in small ways and then in perhaps more dramatic ways, who you are, who you really are at depth, and what matters to you, what is your personal integrity. See, that's a big thing about health. You can cure somebody without touching their personal integrity. But when you heal somebody, they live closer to their personal integrity. And that's possible for everybody.
What's the missing ingredient?
Well, the missing ingredient is probably to find somebody who can see who you are, who believes in it, who reflects it back to you, who shares it with you, who is willing to have the courage to do things in your own way, to make your life as much as you can your own life, not somebody else's life. So many people are living somebody else's life and living by somebody else's values as well. I think it weakens us. I think it actually makes us vulnerable to disease, Armand. What do you think?
I think so, too. I could certainly. And I think it makes, you know, makes the physicians are vulnerable to their own diseases, which could be which is depression.
Absolutely.
Which is so
hopelessness.
Yeah.
And not to say anything about a well, let's not go to the medical system because you're the medical
system. Well, let's go to the medical system.
That someone who is frightened, someone who has gotten a diagnosis that terrifies them. I have 15 minutes to talk to this person? I mean, you got to be kidding me. I mean, who can be who can do? We're all living below the level of our excellence. We know how to be better doctors. We are better doctors than the system allows us to be. And I don't know, is this true in psychology as well, Armand?
It is. It is. And we're trying to, we find that it's easy enough for the students to find their own hearts because somewhere they have that value around. I think physicians have a little tougher time. I think it gets drummed out of them more.
It does. But, you know, part of this, some of the work that one might think people do a lot with is remedial. But I thought I didn't want to do something that was remedial. I wanted to do something preventative. I wanted to take very young students and give them the tools to remember themselves. And some of these tools are very, very simple. Very, very, very simple. It helps people to see their work not only through their minds but also through the heart. I think that's the key. I think the heart is the key of everything. And it's not a valentine. A heart is not a valentine. It's also not soft. It's a way of seeing, such that you see the meaning behind daily, ordinary events. Most of us live so much more meaningful lives than we realize. Events of great meaning happen to us, and we walk right past it because we're only seeing with our minds, but not with our hearts. And that this is all, you know, you teach people, or let's put it this way, together in community, you learn the power to do things differently than the way you're being taught to do them in the training. And that's, to me, that's been key. It's been key.
What happens with the physicians as they get near their burnout levels?
Well, you know, there's a certain, it doesn't take long. This is a very difficult training. It's people are a good percentage of students experience burnout for various periods of time, even in medical school, certainly in residency. I mean, when I was a resident, well, fortunately, the law says you can only work an 80-hour week as a resident. This limits the amount of work that you could, the amount of time you can be in the hospital, 80 hours. When I was doing this, you were on and awake for 36 hours, and then you were off for 12 hours. Needless to say, you slept. Then you got up and you did 36 hours again, and then you went to sleep for 12 hours for 3 years, Armand.
Hmm. But what's the intention?
That has a personal cost, a huge one.
What do you think the intention is? Is the intention to burn you out?
No, not
so that
at
you,
all.
What's the intention? Why would it be such
to teach you everything that you could possibly encounter, which is impossible.
But the mind doesn't work like that. The mind won't take in that information.
Well, I think that, well, certainly the heart doesn't take in the information that's around a person in a setting like this. You get into survival mode. Mm. 80 hours a week? How many of us have ever worked 80 hours a week? And these are young people
who should
be out meeting other people and having families and, you know, enjoying their young time.
But Rachel, it seems criminal. It doesn't seem just wrong.
Well, I've never said that in Grand Rapids.
Okay, but it does seem criminal. It's like you're putting them through basic training.
Let's put it this way. Let's be a little bit. It seems profoundly unwise that we would be wounding the people who we turn to for healing in such a way that, with the best intentions in the world, they don't have the reserve to give us. That's ridiculous. A doctor is a resource for a whole community. You treat your resources, like food and water and things like this, with respect, because we all need the help. All of us need the help.
And it's hard. It's hard for them to get the very respect, the feeling of being more than just an automatic machine. And then you take that very physician and you move that physician to offering them, well, here's one easy way out, do procedures.
Yeah, well, exactly.
It's like a relief from the pressure, the procedure.
X, whatever X is. Yes.
So we'll give you a procedure and we'll also give you medicines to sell. And that'll give you another relief from the pressure we're putting on you. So if I sit on your head long enough and then I tell you, but if you learn how to do skin doctoring, mm-hmm. right, you will never mm-hmm. have to take an emergency call.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
person says, oh, what a relief, I'll become that kind of a doctor. Mm-hmm. And if you learn to prescribe medications, you'll never have to deal with the grief. So it's almost like you pressure them.
I think something interesting, a certain percentage of people need to awaken and say, you know, I'm not living as what is it Oprah says, my best life.
Mm-hmm.
That's so important, that message that she has put out across the country. Live your best life. And what people suddenly realize is they don't know what their best life is. They never paid any attention to themselves. They haven't listened to themselves generously. Every time they have a thought about themselves, they say, oh, well, you know, I'm not sure I like that. That's not good enough. That's not very smart. I'm stupid or whatever. And they don't listen to who they really are because of depth. Everyone is beautiful. Everyone makes sense. Everyone is a survivor of difficulties. Everyone is precious and unique. And that medicine is based on that. May I see in all who suffer only the fellow human being. You know? Yeah. And I tell the students this very basic thing. Across the country, we tell the students, no one is a doctor the way you are a doctor. Do this your own way. Bring your own qualities, your own love, your own kindness, your own life experience to this. Because, you know, you're not a widget. We're not turning you into a widget surgeon or a widget internist. This is your tool to express your deepest values into the world, your wish to leave the world a better world because you've passed through it. You have a great set of tools to do that. And you need to find your own way to do it.
You know, it would be it would be wonderful if a number of physicians could somehow be gathered just to hang out at a party with you. You know, that's it's a
truly, Armand, it's not just me. There's an undercurrent. There's a groundswell. We are not going to have the same system 10 years from now as we have today.
Because the one that's breaking down now is going to reconstitute, you're saying, hopefully in a more humanistic way.
I think so. I think that everyone yearns to live by something that they recognize that they can't achieve within the system right now.
Right, because it's silly. I don't know a happy physician. I don't know one. I know every one of them are kind of unhappy with what they're doing. You know where I find the biggest frailties is among anesthesiologists. They're
and
kind of like...
That's a very difficult specialty.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. And the idea is to have people go numb and yourself to go numb.
Mm-hmm.
And you wake up saying, I don't feel anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you think that's, oh, that used to be equated with being effective. I don't feel anything.
You know what's so sad about this? Medicine is a front row seat on life. The reason I became a doctor many years ago is that I had a sense if I just sat there and just shared people's lives like this, I might grow up to be wise.
Mm.
I might grow up to feel at the end of my life, it was worth it.
Mm.
It was worth it. And, you know, if you can dumb down an experience like this so that people are burning out, surrounded by meaning, by you see everything. You see the loyalty of people, the deep love of people, the courage of remarkable people. A 2-year-old or a 10-year-old can show you courage and sacrifice that is awesome. You know, there's so much in medicine that's filled with awesome and also with mystery, and people are burning out doing it. That's about the system. That's not about medicine.
Yeah, aren't we lucky? So there is an evolution coming, and, you know, and you're part of it, and you're such a beautiful part of it. I mean, it's so, you know, it's a wonderful thing. I love my work. I love at this point in my life, and I'm sure you do at this point in your life, the difference that we're making is so significant. It touches so many different people.
I hope so.
Now through the internet, we're going around the globe and we're getting letters and somebody's listening to you in Taiwan just as we broadcast this today.
I love it.
I got a letter from Haiti yesterday saying we listened to you in Haiti. It's beautiful that we were able to get out there and with a concept that you have. That touches a lot of people. So I really appreciate what we've been able to do here. And of course, I'd like to refer people to the article in the New York Times called Medicine's Search for Meaning, and then onto your websites.
Which is rachelremen.com is one of them.
That's one of them. And then the
other one is called Ishi Programs, ISHI Programs.org.
is sheprograms.org.
And .org.
We're going to be talking more about how we might be able to do even more with WBAI and Pacifica. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
It's such a pleasure to connect with you again. You know, you've held to certain values for all of your life, and I find that very inspirational, actually, Armand. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Be back with you again, Rachel. I'll be speaking to you soon.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Dr. Rachel Remen of the very famous Dr. Rachel Remen. It was an awful lot to say. Check it out, my friends. That was a real honor to be able to speak with this person who's been amazing her whole life. We'll be back with you soon. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you would. And just shortly thereafter, it'll be up on thepositivemind.com. Also, send me an email telling me what you thought of today's program, what you would like to hear, questions that you might have, and whether or not you'd like me to read that email on the air. The email address is armand@thepositivemind.com. armand@thepositivemind.com.
You keep going your way, I'll keep going my way. River, stay away from my door. I just got a cabin. You don't need my cabin. River, stay away from my door. Don't come up any higher. I'm so all alone. Leave my bed and my fire. That's all I own. I ain't breaking your heart. Don't start breaking my heart. River, stay away from my door. Keep going your way, I'll keep going my way. River, stay away from my door. I just got a cabin. You don't need my cabin. River, stay away from my door. Don't come up any higher. I'm so all alone. Leave my bed and my fire. That's all I own. I ain't breaking your heart. Don't start breaking my heart. from my door. Stay away from my door. River, stay away from my door.